Welcome to another edition of Pioneer Radio, a student-centered program giving you the voices of the campus to the community. In this episode, we'll be hearing stories of wealth, economics, and philosophy.
I think economics, it's not just like subject or discipline. It's more than this. It's like philosophy. It gives you or provides some special logical way how we can solve problems.
Frank Hunt Gonzalez sits down with the LGBT Alliance Club ambassadors, Sherrod Worthen and Alex Adams.
One of the hardest things about coming out and coming to terms with your sexuality, especially if you're LGBT, is just that sense of self-acceptance and realizing that you are not the only person on campus or the only person in the world who feels this way.
We'll hear those stories plus more coming up in the next hour. I'm your host, Bill Piacese, and this is Pioneer Radio. To start us off, recently our own Carrie Dulcio sat down with Stephen Dubner, co-author of the international bestseller Freakonomics. They discussed everyday economics in our politics as well as in our society.
With students who are in school right now and they're about to enter into the economy of today, what's some advice you'd give to them?
This is going to sound terrible, but a lot of what your parents say is probably ludicrous. And the reason is that the world has changed a lot since your parents were coming into the job market. And it really used to be that you kind of saw this career ladder and you climbed it. And that worked pretty well. Like they'd have a pension and all this stuff. And now it is definitely a much, much more kind of create your own adventure economy. And I think the single best thing to do is to, this is going to sound also terrible, I was going to say to make people like or appreciate you, but I don't mean this in a manipulative way. I don't mean like, you know, bring in treats or, I mean, whatever, if you want to bring in treats. But the point is that make yourself really valuable. And I think a lot of that is related to the same entrepreneurial spirit of, you know, if you want to create your own career, create your own adventure, obviously you have to be very entrepreneurial at that. But I think even if you're working at a company, if you get a job doing in a position that has been done many times before by many different people, and everyone thinks that they understand exactly what that job entails, exactly what duties and so on, that is, you can do that. And you can succeed, but just think how much better it would be if you were to take care of all the things that are expected of you, and you also like come up with three other things to do that's good for the company. Be a contributor, be creative, and be kind of childlike in your enthusiasm for you know, what's good and what's worthwhile.
What would you say has been missing from our discussions about economics and politics in the news today?
Logic. I mean, there's just a lot of emotion and a lot of dogma that goes into most economic arguments. Plus, it's, if you're talking about in the news, like journalism, like I'm a proud member of the journalistic community, even though I don't really practice journalism. Well, my podcast is straight up journalism. Honestly, it really is. It's very different from the way I did stuff when I worked at the New York Times. It's got a different voice and stuff, but it's really very similar. But most journalists aren't very comfortable with data and empirical, you know, academic research and stuff like that. There's a lot of journalists who come from the humanities and are kind of attracted to the storytelling and even the cause of journalism a little bit. So I think that part of the problem is that a lot of the treatment in the news of economics and politics is reduced to like the narrowest, shallowest version of it, of the issue. And I think that's a problem because, you know, life is complicated. And when you write these simple stories, it's so-and-so said such and such, and therefore he is a blank. You know, the world doesn't work like that.
Is it sometimes hard to translate the information from something that's more mathematical and, you know, large to something that's more easier to digest?
It is hard. And I've been doing it for long enough now that I've gotten a little bit better at it. But the best thing I know how to do is to ask the people who write it, if it's very mathematical or very dense, I just say to them, look, this seems like it's interesting. I want to understand it. I don't understand it. Please explain it to me better. And look, I've been doing journalism a long time, and I'm not embarrassed to do that. So I think that people starting out in journalism should not be embarrassed to do that. And I think people starting out in business should not be embarrassed to do that. I think it's very empowering to say, listen, I get it. I know this is important. I get the gist of it, but I really don't. I need you to explain this to me. And I find that almost always people are really eager to hear that and then explain it. So I still do that a lot.
Would you say that that more simplistic type of speaking might have helped a guy like Trump win? Because he does, you know, speak on a simpler level.
Yeah, I think the other thing about Trump that's not to be forgotten is that, you know, politics, electoral politics, not governing, but electoral politics really is, at the end of the day, mostly a popularity contest. And I'm not saying that issues don't count, but people, you know, there's this thing in showbiz called a Q score, a Q rating, which is basically just like if you're an actor or an actress and someone's thinking about casting you, they look up your Q rating, and that's kind of what determines it. And even though politics is obviously more complex than that, most people end up voting for someone that feels like the kind of person they want to vote for, the kind of person they want to like, the kind of person they feels represents them in some way. Not, and I mean, there's a lot of data showing that often people vote against their own like economic self-interest for someone who kind of feels more like them. So in terms of President Trump, you know, put aside for a minute the fact that he appealed to a lot of people, he's also really good at doing it because he's been doing it as an entertainer and as a, you know, I live in New York where he's been a fixture for like 25 years as a public figure. And he really does speak in sound bites. And, you know, someone can ridicule that if they want, say it's an indication that you're shallow. Maybe, but maybe not.
With regard to politics, would you say that it's more honorable to stick to your guns or to try to find some type of middle ground with the other side?
Yeah, I'm not a gun sticker too. I mean, well, because stick to your guns implies not just being loyal to your passion or your cause, but also being, and maybe this is not the way you meant it, but also being really convinced that you're right. And so you may not have meant it that way, but I do think that in politics especially, the system is created where you kind of declare your position, and then in order for you to move, even just like budge 10%, it's seen as a loss. And I think that's a real problem.
Is there something that you yourself are trying to incentivize anybody to do?
Well, I guess we do it with our kids a fair amount. And it's kind of trial and error, I have to say. It's a little bit hard. You know, the problem with kids is you only have a few at a time. What you really need to do is have like a million, then randomize them and divide them into like four groups and try different treatment groups and control groups. And that's how you'd really find out. That's kind of what schools are, but schools don't even really randomize that much. So the problem is that to really put incentives to use in a kind of scientific, empirical way, you do need to do it more like a randomized controlled trial. Whereas what we often think of as like randomizing is really just like trial and error. Often the incentives that work are not the ones that you would predict work.
In the morning we built the city.
In the afternoon walked through its streets.
Evening saw us leaving. We wandered through our days as if they would never end. All of us imagined we had endless time to spend. We hardly saw the crossroads and small attention gave to landmarks on the journey from the cradle to the grave. Cradle to the grave, cradle to the grave.
Did you learn to dream in the morning?
abandon dreams in the afternoon.
Wait without hope in the evening.
Did you stand there in the traces and let them feed you lies? Did you trail along behind them wearing blinkers on your eyes? Did you kiss the foot that kicked you? Did you thank them for their scorn? Did you ask for their forgiveness for the act of being born? Act of being born, act of being born. Did you alter the face of the city?
Make any change in the world you found?
Or did you observe all the warnings? Did you read the trespass notices? Did you keep off the grass? Did you shuffle off the pavement just to let your betters pass? Did you learn to keep your mouth shut? Were you seen and never heard? Did you learn to be obedient and jump to at a word? Jump to at a word? Jump to at a word?
Did you ever demand any answers?
The who and the what and the reason why?
Did you ever question the setup?
Did you stand aside and let them choose while you took second best? Did you let them skim the cream off and then give to you the rest? Did you settle for the shoddy and did you think it right to let them rob you right and left and never make a fight? Never make a fight, never make a fight. What did you learn in the morning?
How much did you know in the afternoon?
Were you content in the evening? Did they teach you how to question when you were at the school? Did the factory help you grow? Were you the maker or the tool? Did the place where you were living enrich your life? And then did you reach some understanding of all your fellow men, all your fellow men, all your fellow men?
Theoretical economist Joan Robinson once said, "The purpose of studying economics is not to acquire a set of ready-made answers to economic questions, but to learn how to avoid being deceived by economists." In this next piece, we'll hear from Dan Kotherman and IRSC professor Dr. Larissa Ray. Dr. Ray, whose native country is Russia, explains to us why she became interested in economics and why it would be beneficial for all students to learn.
All right, so Dr. Ray, glad to have you here today. I just want to talk about your educational background first. How did you get your PhD?
Hello to everyone. I got my PhD in Russia. Mm-hmm. I finished like one of the biggest universities in Russia, Lobachevsky State University. And I also have a master's degree in business and administration. Also based in Lobachevsky State University, Nizhny Novgorod, Russia.
Okay, so what was it that made you want to come over to America with those degrees?
Well, it was many reasons. One of them was my personal reason. I got married, and that was the major reason why I moved to Florida specifically. Mm-hmm. And then I also wanted to try something different. Why not? And teach economics in English. It's kind of cool. And I didn't do this before. And I always like to try something new.
Sure, sure. Was there any difference that you noticed between learning economics and the system basically in Russia versus teaching and learning it over here?
Well, the system, of course, is different. In Russia, I worked at university, and it's a state university where they had like a classic system with groups, classes that go through from the first level to the highest level, the same people. So they don't have Like we have this system with the points, mm-hmm. with different major subjects, not so many options like here. Here okay. It's a different, it's more flexible. And actually, I learned a lot here about the new system, how I can apply it to my method, to my style of teaching. So it was a lot of new and different things, but I like here is better.
sure. No, it's excellent.
Here is better.
Yeah. Do you have any favorite memories from your economic studies, whether it be like a big research project or I don't know, just any memory that stuck out to you as being an important moment?
Before, I had a different major subject. I had psychology. So I started like a psychologist, finished my bachelor's degree as a psychologist. And then somehow I started like reading books, popular books of some famous economists. First, I started at like management of psychology, and then I found like so many interesting ideas and philosophy. And finally, I ended up in a new major subject for myself, and I decided to be an economist. And then I finished like master's degree in economics. So to me, I think the most favorite memory, I think it's reading books, reading books of this popular economist, like started with Adam Smith, probably, in his The Wealth of Nations, and then to Milton Friedman, Capitalism and Freedom, things like that. So,
no, it's excellent.
Just reading.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of students can also appreciate not knowing exactly where they want to go, but somehow ending up where they need to be. So. So let's hop into some more general questions. So why would you say that it's important for people that aren't interested in economics as a major to still study economics? What benefits can they get from studying economics?
I think economics, it's not just a like subject or discipline. It's more than this. It's like philosophy. It gives you or provides some special logical way how we can solve problems. And the problems could be anything or about anything. It's not just about businesses or incomes, but it could be about unemployment. It could be about inflation. So anyone could be benefited from learning economics as a consumer, as a citizen, as a just an individual. You know, so that's the major idea. So why we need to study economics? Because anyone could be benefited.
Sure,
so,
makes you a more well-rounded person.
And also, it's a different way of thinking. It's a special way of thinking, critical way, economic way, I would say. Economic thinking, how we can solve the problems. And
definitely, yeah. I've had to apply that in your class as well. You have to apply a much more analytical style to
analytical
your problems,
style,
right?
Critical style.
Critical style, right.
Yeah.
Okay, so what would you say that your favorite topic is in economics?
I would pick specifically microeconomics. And in microeconomics, my favorite topic would be concept of supply and demand. Because, again, you can apply this concept for almost everything in economics. And if you work in, for example, you can understand how markets work, what market price is. If you're not working in businesses or somewhere like that, you can learn about how you can behave as a consumer. How you can reach the point of maximum consumer surplus. So that's why I would say it's a major, major concept for the entire economics. And specifically, if you at the very beginning, if you just start studying, learning economics.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, and that's chapter 4 in our book is when supply and demand is introduced.
I think it's chapter 4,
yeah. So it's so early and it's so critical to every part of every other chapter in the book. Yeah. Okay, so lastly, I just wanted to ask you, what is some advice that you would give to people that want to dedicate themselves to economic studies in the future?
My advice would be keep learning, keep studying, study economics. Don't be afraid of math, because it's not only graphs and equations. It's much more that you can find and be benefited, and probably it will help you to get better paid jobs or decent job in the future.
Well, Dr. Ray, thank you very much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
You're listening to Pioneer Radio. Up next, Frank Hunt Gonzalez talks to students Sherrod Worthen and Alex Adams, ambassador for the LGBT Alliance Club.
I'm here today with Sherrod and Alex, club officers from IRSC's newly formed LGBT Club. I just have a few questions about the group itself, as well as how you decided to form this group. What is your club's mission, and what do you do?
Our main goal is just to create a safe space on campus for LGBT students, as well as a place that they can express themselves openly and comfortably around like-minded people.
And it's not just for, like, LGBT people. It's not just, like, a gays-only place. It's for everyone, and it's just an accepting community for everyone to come together. And it's kind of like a family for people who don't really have family. Like, it's a great place to just feel like you belong.
Is there anything you'd like students and faculty to know about your group or the LGBT community as a whole?
Just to sort of echo what Alex said, one of the big things that we try to stress when we're promoting our events and promoting our meetings is that the club is for everyone. LGBT or LGBT-friendly people are more than welcome to join us.
Also like them to know that it is a very active community. We do plan on like doing a lot of fundraisers, a lot of volunteering. It's not just a meet and greet. I mean, we do that a lot, and it's a lot of fun, but we do have like purposes that we want to contribute, and that we're going to be a club that is reliable and definitely contributes a lot to the community.
What's the hardest thing that you've had to deal with when forming this group?
Because ours is such a new club, trying to create a schedule that fits in with everyone's classwork and work schedules has been a bit of an issue. And so we've actually just opted to meet twice a week, and we will probably continue that into next semester, just because with something like this, we can't afford to tell people that we will offer them community next semester or that the community will be there on Tuesday. And so we do try to make sure that we hit as many people as we can and maximize our availability.
And what days are you meeting now?
Tuesdays from 4 to 5 and Wednesday from 2 to 3 in the KSU. Usually we'll reserve room 107 if we can, or the student lounge. And if not, we just meet in the cafeteria.
Are there any events that you are planning on participating in?
We are actually planning to be a part of Club Rush in the spring semester. We're also going to be volunteering a lot and helping out with the Winter Ball coming up on January 27th.
Is there anything specific that you are hoping to accomplish as a group on campus this semester or school year?
I think to grow is probably what we hope to accomplish. Like Sherrod said earlier, we're just starting out, and so we have We actually have a pretty good turnout for a beginning club, but we'd like to see those numbers just skyrocket. We need a lot of people to start like doing the projects that we're planning on doing in the future, like I said earlier, volunteering. And yeah, I think that's just our main goal.
Looking further into the future, where do you see this group 5 years from now?
If our club can still function and still operate 5 years from now, that would be great. That is the goal. We already have some interest from people in the Mueller campus. We have a student who rides the bus out from Sebastian to our Wednesday meetings. And we have someone else from the Chastain campus who I met recently. But she said that she wants to come, and she feels like their campuses kind of get left out of things like this, especially when you have a new club forming. So if we could get an LGBT established on all of the IRSC campuses, that would be great. Even just as a long-term goal for the next 5 years or so.
What would you say to students that are thinking of joining your group?
What are you waiting for? Honestly, I would just say, in all seriousness, that it's a lot of fun to go to. It's a great place to feel like you belong. It's for everyone. And honestly, there's really no reason not to try it out. Oh, we're just all a very accepting community, and we love new members.
What is one thing that you think students will learn from their time as members of this group?
We do have a lot of younger students in our group. Some of them are dual-enrolled high schoolers, and I came out around that time. I was about 17, and one of the hardest things about coming out and coming to terms with your sexuality, especially if you're LGBT, is just that sense of self-acceptance and realizing that you are not the only person on campus or the only person in the world who feels this way. And so having people to be open and be out around, it will help our group members learn to love and accept themselves.
I think it's definitely important for LGBT youth to definitely know that it is okay and that everything that they're going through, that they're not alone in it. And I hope that they find, like, basically a sense, like, I mean, we've reiterated it many times, but a sense of belonging is definitely really important. I hope they, like, learn to be more confident in their sexuality. I mean, like, as a straight person, I don't really relate to what they go through, but I want them to also know that, actually, that's another thing. I hope that the straight people who do come know how to be more sensitive and to be more respectful and to have better understanding of LGBT people, because there's a lot of stigma still around it. And if we have, like, not only LGBT people understanding themselves, if we also have straight people understanding them, then that's just a huge accomplishment for us. So I hope they learn a lot from their experience with us.
Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2.
She packed my bags last night pre-flight. 0 hours, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then.
All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
I miss the earth so much, I miss my wife. It's lonely out in space. Such a timeless flight. I think it's gonna be a long, long time. Touchdown brings me round again to find I'm not the man they think I am at home. Oh, no, no, no. I'm a rocket man. Rocket man. Burning at his fears up here at home. Mars ain't the kind of place to raise your kids. In fact, it's cold as ice. No one there to raise them. If you did, and all the science I don't understand, it's just my job 5 days a week. Rocket Man.
Once again, here's Frank Hunt Gonzalez, who considers the economic implications of the North Carolina HB2 bill, which passed in March of 2016.
Controversial North Carolina law, titled Public Facilities Privacy and Security Act, also called HB2 or the Bathroom Bill, has caused significant financial strain on the state of North Carolina. House Bill 2 was formed as a response to Charlotte Ordinance 7056, which was voted in 7-4. This ordinance expanded the city of Charlotte's existing non-discrimination policy to include members of the LGBT community. The ordinance applied to private businesses and private transportation services such as taxis. The more controversial part of the Charlotte ordinance required businesses to allow transgender individuals to use the men's or women's restrooms based on the gender that they identify as not as their biological sex or what is listed on their birth certificate. Charlotte Ordinance 7056 was set to go in effect April 1, 2016, but on March 23, 2016, the North Carolina House of Representatives held a special session and passed HB2 with 82 in favor and 26 against. A few hours later, the state Senate also passed HB2 with 32 in favor, while 11 Democrats walked out in protest, refusing to vote. On the same day, HB2 was signed into law by Governor McCrory. There are a few key parts to North Carolina's House Bill 2. In public schools and public agencies, individuals must use the restrooms, locker rooms, and dressing rooms that corresponds with the sex listed on their birth certificate. It restricts cities in North Carolina from enacting any anti-discrimination policies. It restricts cities from setting a local minimum wage or regulating child labor. It also restricts cities from making certain kinds of regulations for city workers. Several groups, including the White House, feel that HB2 is discriminatory towards the LGBT community, and there has been a public outcry denouncing the law and requesting its immediate repeal. Celebrities and musicians have pulled their events from the state of North Carolina in protest of HB2, while some have continued to have their events in the state while being vocal about their opposition to the law, and several have donated a portion of their profits to groups fighting HB2. Among the musicians that have canceled concerts in North Carolina are Bruce Springsteen, Pearl Jam, Ringo Starr, Demi Lovato, Nick Jonas, Boston, and Maroon 5. Mumford & Sons sent the profits from one of their shows in North Carolina to charity. Duran Duran played a show that had Equality North Carolina members passing out petitions to concertgoers, while composer Stephen Schwartz announced that he will no longer allow his musicals to be performed in the state. Several entertainment events were also canceled in opposition to HB2, including Cirque du Soleil, which canceled dates in North Carolina for 2 tours. According to a report released by the Williams Institute, a group that does research at UCLA Law, HB2 potentially could cost North Carolina almost $5 billion a year, in the form of $4.8 billion in federal funding, which includes $4.7 billion in Title IX funding for colleges and public schools, over $40 million in business investments that have been pulled from the state, and a decrease in revenue from tourism and event spending. The Charlotte Chamber has estimated that 1,300 jobs have been lost in the Charlotte area due to HB2. The Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau has estimated a loss of $40 million in convention business, with at least 20 conventions and events scheduled for Charlotte deciding on a new location. Some library organizations that had meetings or conferences scheduled in the state decided to find a new venue, including the Association for Library Services to Children. Several businesses have withdrawn or stopped planned expansions in the state as form of protest of HB2. PayPal was scheduled to have a major expansion worth $3.6 billion, which would have created over 400 new jobs. A global banking company was also scheduled to have an expansion, which would have employed 250 people. Red Ventures, an internet marketing company, is currently reconsidering an expansion that would have added 500 jobs. Lionsgate moved the filming of a new comedy for Hulu called Crush from North Carolina to Canada, which would have added 100 jobs. With North Carolina being such a big sports state, hosting more men's college basketball games than any other state in the last 65 years, another great loss was several sporting events that were pulled in opposition of HB2. The NBA All-Star Game was removed from the state, which, according to the Charlotte Regional Visitors Authority, will end up leaving the state with a $100 million loss, although the NBA has offered Charlotte the opportunity to host the All-Star Weekend as early as 2019. The Atlantic Coast Conference, or the ACC, pulled several championships for the 2016-17 season from North Carolina, including the ACC's football title game, which was scheduled for Charlotte. The NCAA has also announced that they are removing 7 championships from the state, which results in at least $20 million in lost revenue. North Carolina is also seeking to host several other NCAA championships over the next 6 years, which could potentially be worth tens of millions of dollars. No matter what your position is on the issue of this law, no one can deny the huge financial and social impact that it has had in the state. Unfortunately, only time will tell us how much more of an impact HB2 will play on the state, its residents, and the way the rest of the country views North Carolina.
My sex change operation got botched. My guardian angel fell asleep on the watch. Now all I've got is a Barbie doll crotch. I've got an angry inch. 6 inches far.
You're listening to Pioneer Radio.
do you do with the mad that you feel when you feel so mad you could bite? When the whole wide world seems oh so wrong and nothing you do seems very right? What do you do? Do you punch a bag? Do you pound some clay or some dough? Do you round up friends for a game of tag or see how fast you go? It's great to be able to stop when you've planned a thing that's wrong and be able to do something else instead and think this song. I can stop when I want to, can stop when I wish, can stop, stop, stop anytime. And what a good feeling to feel like this and know that the feeling is really mine. Know that there's something deep inside that helps us become what we can.
From Indian River State College, this is Pioneer Radio. Coming up next, we'll hear the second part of Dan Kotherman's interview with Mia Tigner on the One Book, One College event.
So I'd like for you to expand on why you chose Edgewood Stantecat.
So one of the reasons why we chose Brother I'm Dying was because it was a memoir. So we had done a fiction work last time, and we really wanted something that had not only cross-curricular connections, but also current events connections as well. So one thing about Brother I'm Dying is that it is her memoir. It talks about her family in both Haiti and New York and what it was like for her as a young girl to actually live with her aunt and uncle while her parents were living in New York. So a lot of the book is about her relationship with each member of her family and how even though it was her aunt and her uncle, she had just as strong of a relationship with them as she did with her mother and father as well. One of the other things we really liked about it is that at the end of the novel, things come to light about her family and her situation that were actually covered in the national news as well. So we wanted to make sure that there was a book that not only was a really, really great read because she's a really fantastic lyrical writer, but also that you could connect to current events issues both within the book and things that are happening today in the world. One other reason why we really wanted to choose Edwige is that we had seen several of her lectures before, several of her talks, and she's a really engaging public speaker. And with the NEA grants, we are actually able to bring her to the campus, and we wanted to make sure that she would be an engaging speaker in general, too. One of the other reasons that we chose her work was that she is a current author and she is an award-winning author. And she's not only putting out works of memoir, but she's also written books like The Dewbreaker, which is a work of fiction, Crick Crack, which is actually a work of short stories, as well as other nonfiction books about the writing process too. So she has this great collection of writing that we could draw from and we could create different events and different creative outputs for students too, because we wanted to make sure that it wasn't just read a book and answer the questions, but read a book and then talk about your experiences as a person, talk about your experiences as a family member, or create something in conjunction with the work as well.
Right. And I definitely appreciate the sort of combination of, matching the theme of the book to the goals of the program. Last year you were saying with Frankenstein, you wanted people to take away different, people would come in from different educational backgrounds and they would give their input based on that for
Absolutely.
This work of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So for something more intimate and personal, this memoir, I'm very curious to see what the response is from people with something a little more grounded.
Yep.
Obviously, Frankenstein is more out there than a grounded memoir about the trials and tribulations of immigration.
Yep, absolutely. We loved Frankenstein because we loved how many different ways that you could enter the work. But we really like Edwige Stantecat's work, too, because it's a little bit easier for students to enter as well, because sometimes the epistolary format of Frankenstein gets a little bit confusing for students to deal with. And we wanted to see how they would really interact with the more current book as well. We've actually had several classes read the book this semester, and the current feedback's been fantastic, so we can't wait for our actual grant period to start, too.
That's excellent. Going forward, do you think that you will continue this? Well, I mean, you're only 2 years into the trend, so it's hard to establish a trend, but do you think that you will trade off between more grounded and realistic stories and more stories based in science fiction or other fiction, basically? Where do you see the program as far as the balance between reading fiction and reading these personal titles.
Absolutely. So with the trade-off, we've been really lucky to get really fantastic book choices so far. And I think that the choices for the books in the future will always depend on what different types of grants we might be able to apply for, like the NEA grant, or if a book's in the public domain, or if there's a college-wide event or a community event that might also work with a specific title. So in the future, we'd love to get more input from the college community in general. We're definitely going to make sure that we take a lot of surveys and do a lot of research about how people like different types of books and how they interact with those books too. We did change the time period from the fall, which was last year, to the spring of this year. So we want to see how that changes our process too. But as people become more familiar with it, I've had a lot of students, because they were expecting that one book program within the fall semester, they came up and asked me, when's our next one book? When are we doing something like this? We really liked the interaction that we saw at the college level. So I'm really excited to see, as people get more involved in it and really think about it as something that IRSC does, that we can continue to really grow the program across our different campuses and communities.
So who are some people that you would love to see either locally or on a national level to be involved with this program in the future?
We really have fantastic levels of faculty, administrative, and staff interaction and student interaction as well. So we really just want to grow what we have and see what we can do in the future. So we want to make sure that, first and foremost, it's an IRSC program, and we want to make sure that we're really engaging our students and community in the ways that we can create those authentic conversations about novels. In the future, I hope that it gets even bigger and bigger, especially as our community becomes more aware of our programs too. A big science fiction reader, I would love someone like N.K. Jemisin, who wrote The First Season, which is one of my favorite books. But as the college answer, we are so excited to have Edwige Denikat actually come and speak that it's hard to think of someone else that would be as awesome to get on campus, to be honest, because she's a fantastic speaker, she's a fantastic writer, and she's a very, very well-known name in the literary community as well. Of course, someone like Ta-Nehisi Coates, who wrote Between the World and Me, would be a fantastic writer and speaker to come to campus too. But there's so many fantastic authors this year that it's hard to pick just one.
Well, thank you very much, Mia, for coming in. Once again, that was Mia Tignor, who is the Emerging Technologies Librarian here at the IRSC main campus. And yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
I found out you wrote the book I read, so
You've made this day a special day by just your being you. There's no person in the whole world like you, and I like you just the way you are.
From Indian River State College, this is Pioneer Radio. I'd like to thank you for listening to this edition of Pioneer Radio. And now a special thanks to Brian Lane, Joe Leonardine, Mia Tigner, Dr. Matthew Brooks, Dr. Bruce Fraser, WQCS, Indian River State College, and National Public Radio. It's been our great pleasure to bring you this edition of Pioneer Radio. We look forward to having you back for our next show. Remember, it's a big world out there. Go explore it.
Tucky Toaster, your chirpy breakfast companion. Tucky's the name, toasting's the game. Anyone like any toast?
Look, I don't want any toast, and he doesn't want any toast. In fact, no one around here wants any toast. Not now, not ever. No toast.
How about a muffin?
Or muffins. We don't like muffins round here. We want no muffins, no toast, no tea cakes, no buns, baps, baguettes or bagels, no croissants, no crumpets, no pancakes, no potato cakes, and no hot cross buns, and definitely no smeggin flapjacks.
Ah, so you're a waffle man.